So thank you very much for this paper acceptance and this invitation. It's great to be here. Lots of familiar faces over the years. We were in a historical mood with Catherine before. Maybe it's interesting to know that the first patent law was approved in Venice in 1474. So probably we can have a better, longer, you know, time window to study. Thank you for once again. And this is a research, collective research with the University of Ferrara and University of Modena and Reggio Emilia. The rationale of this research about unaccounted intangibles is a little bit like starting a walk on the wild side, in a sense. You know, that is the kind of spirit we try to have. Is that at an institutional level, as you know, and thanks Anna to say this for us, as a third consequence of the third agenda consultation, you know that early this year, ISB approved a new research project on IS38, but not only, about intangibles, starting probably in 2024, even if it's not being announced as yet. And the reasons are because, of course, most of the information is evaluated as pervasive and acute, we just quote. And there have been lots of deficiencies, lack of information, also on unrecognized intangible assets. And of course, this project will have an impact, we don't have to forget that, on other projects, like the one on integrated reporting, on management commentary. So it's a very pervasive and, you know, horizontal type of project. It's not just IS38, which is already important per se. But also, we don't have to forget EFRAG. After us, I think there will be our EFRAG friends to deliver, you know, a speech about their progresses and the discussion paper they have on better information on intangibles. And of course, in their view, there's a mix of solutions to address lack of information on intangibles. On regulatory grounds, very rarely I hear this. The CSRD, you know, the new directive, the European directive that is law in Europe, requires explicitly information on unaccounted intangibles. Of course, everybody's worried about the European standards, ESRS, but very, very few are here around in various public fora to talk about this aspect. Corporate reporting practices, especially in Europe, not only, also in Japan, I must say, there's a lot of intangibles in integrated reports. And also in sustainability reports, like, for instance, reputation is part generally of sustainability reporting. And finally, also on the academic grounds, there's been a revival of interest. I just quote a couple of works we did with the same team in the last 2-3 years. One for EFRAG, it was a literature review on intangibles, and one for ICAS, the Chartered Accountants in Scotland, EFRAG, and EFAS. EFAS are the European financial analysts, jointly pushed, fostered our study. And also there's a special issue, Nabacus, probably. There are plenty of those things. So forgive us if we don't quote all of them. So what we drew from this is the fact that most of the accounting studies in journals, they are on accounted or disclosed intangibles. What about the other side of the coin? In generally the regard one category of actors. Remember one, no, generally users, studied by Mazzi and all 2-3 years ago. So we try to somehow, maybe courageously, to drive the attention to the other side of the coin, trying to address initially, of course, it's an initial exploratory study on the lack of data on unaccounted or unrecognized, if you prefer, intangibles. And regarding not only users, but also preparers, that they have to prepare information, which, of course, is part of the of the picture, we think. Of course, information must be useful, we all agree on that, but they also prepare a side, that they have to prepare information. So, just to cut the long story short, we think that the aims of this work is to provide some empirical insights, though preliminary, on the views, on the perceptions of preparers and users regarding the usefulness of intangibles-related information for unaccounted intangibles. And also the comparison between preparers and users, which is often not done. So, of course, we wanted to, you know, be talking about perceived importance. Now we're going to explain the methodology. We're talking about challenges and opportunities, and coming, you know, linked to this information. And, of course, which kind of measures and disclosures they prefer. And finally, of course, that would be the other obvious aim, is to contribute to the ongoing debate we just delineated a few seconds ago. Also providing a set of data that are not, that is not so easily available because they are not disclosed. Please just be patient. Sometimes we talk about unrecognized, unaccounted, unreported. Technically, it's not the same. I understand that. But just because, for the sake of the conversation, sometimes we tend to use this interchangeably. As I said, it's not perfect. But just to say, basically, where there's no when there's no information on that intangible. That's what we mean by unaccounted or unreported. And of course, when we talk about users, we talk about sell-side, buy-side analysts, fund managers, and preparers, the managers in different organizational positions, because they're called CFOs. But sometimes they deal, there are other managerial figures that deal with intangibles, like chief operating officers, chief accounting officer, chief sustainability officers. So we try to be a little bit more comprehensive than the usual, very rigid, if you want, classification. And, of course, important final point, and I pass it on to Laura, usefulness. Here we talk about usefulness for both users and preparers, which are not perfectly consistent with the standards. We know that. So, but we did that on purpose because, of course, we think that also preparers have a say on this, and it would be important to recognize that. So, word to you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Stefano, and it's a pleasure to be here. So, in order to address the research questions that Stefano was referring to, we have been basically based our literature review on three key stream of work. Also bearing in mind that we are talking about unaccounted intangibles. So some of the literature was okay about the intangibles, but we also kind of relied on the concept of intellectual capital to dig into a little bit more what the research has been saying so far on three particular aspects. The first one is who's going to be, for whom is this information useful? And is there a consensus or there is no consensus? So what we found in the scant literature that is available to date on this particular topic is that actually both preparer and users tend to perceive intangibles related information as useful, but sometimes there's going to be a difference in the professional experience on this particular topic. The other stream of research that we have been relying on is what kind of information, and especially unaccounted type of information, can be useful. And again, in relation to preparers and users, and what we found and what the literature says until now is that basically, especially when it comes to human capital type of information that is most useful for preparers, but then relational type of capital information. So, for example, information related to the relationship with the customers or the suppliers is perceived as most useful by preparers, users, or also both of them. And the third type of stream of research that we have been relying on is where this type of information should be located. We all know that the traditional financial statement is not perfect, and so where else? To date, we know that, as Stefano mentioned, in order to cope with this type of problem, there have been various initiatives. So, for example, the integrated report, a little bit of the recent management commentary exposure draft, but also other type of models that have been proposed. So coming to the research methodology, as Stefano said, the overall aim of this study was really to here from the users and preparers distinctively investigated what their idea, what their views are on unaccounted intangibles. But in order to do that, we have been focusing on the same type of questions submitted both to users and preparers. And in order to do this, we have been using a kind of a complementary research method. So we started with a global survey, and this was mainly to gather a wider understanding of what are the views of these categories of stakeholders on unaccounted information. And then we dig a little bit more with two focus groups. One was about was organized with preparers and another one with users. That was mainly to make sure and to understand whether the views that we gather through the global survey was confirmed or not by those that are considered as experts. And in order to do that, we also decided not to rely on any particular type of hypothesis, but really the idea was to let the data speak for itself. And as I'm going to say in a minute, always from a methodological viewpoint, we have been also gone a little bit more into the details of descriptive statistic for the data that we gather through the global survey and transcription of the meeting when it comes to the focus groups. So a little bit of details on the survey. It has been made available for basically a month for anyone interested to reply to the survey. And that is important to note because we are going to focus this study on users and preparers, but there are also other stakeholders who have been replying to the survey, such as academics, auditors, and so on. And this is also important to note the date, because we have been submitting this survey in 2021, when the European Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive wasn't out yet, and that is might influence some of the results, especially when it comes to the location type of results that we gather. In terms of how this survey was shared, it was a web-based survey, and the completion time was about 30 minutes. How the survey was structured? It was structured into two key sessions. One was about to gather personal and professional data, for really no indication on the name and the surname, and also not even the name of the companies, these, especially the preparers we're working on. And then a section on the general question, really to understand the views of preparers on the treatment on the intangibles largely conceived. And it is also important to note that in order to gather all the possible details also through the survey, we also decided to include some mutually exclusive or single choice answers, but also add space after the survey where respondents could provide their own views. When it comes to the focus group, we have been
Can we thank EFRAG, EFAS, and ICAS because they supported that?
Yeah. I was going to do that now because after that we collected the survey, we have been organizing the focus group, as I said before, with preparers and users, and we convened them for about 3 hours each. And the idea was really to understand from them whether they could confirm or not some of the results that we got through the survey, and especially with a focus on the most dissonant views that we gathered. Maybe I can, and yes, as Stefano said, thanks a lot to EFRAG for helping us, especially in this particular phase of the project in getting the members of the focus groups. So as I said before, a further complementary analysis on this type of data. So we have been running some descriptive statistics on the data that we gathered through the survey, and in particular, 4 categorical responses, the p-value was analyzed employing a Q-square test, and then numerical responses, the analysis of variance. On the focus group, as I said before, we may rely on the transcription of the meetings. So let's get to the results now. Here you can see a little bit of the numbers that we got. So out of the 314 stakeholders who initially participated in the survey, 165 completed the survey. So we're able to go through and provide a response to all the questions that we have been asking. In terms of the profile of the respondents, as you can see, we are mainly focused on users and preparers. So the majority of users were belonging to the sci-fi analyst, while when it comes to preparers, they were mainly from unlisted companies and large companies. It is also important to note that the majority of people who replied to this survey were mainly coming from Europe. And this provides you with an idea of the general questions that we have been asking. So starting from the level of satisfaction of the information which is currently provided according to IES 38, but then also going a little bit more into, as I was mentioning before, details as what should be the measurement basis, where this type of information should be located, the need for auditing, and also the need of standardization of this type of information. Let's come to the results now. So this also provides you, these couple of slides are going to provide you with an idea of the descriptive statistic that we have been performing on the data of the survey. So for example, the first question was really to understand whether is there any useful information missing from today's financial reporting, so provided according to IES 38. We can see that in general, there was a consensus, even if actually users were more inclined to say yes as compared to preparers. And as I said, this is providing you with an idea of what has been the test that we have been performing. So the p-value according to the Q-square and the likelihood of ratio, which is basically telling us that it is possible to find an association between the response and the fact that users were more inclined to say, yes, there is the information missing as compared to preparers. When it comes to the relevant categories of intangibles that are missing from today's financial reporting, preparers tend to privilege information on R&D, human capital, and intangibles-related risks and opportunities, while when it comes to users, it is much more information about IP and know-how and intangibles-related risks and opportunities. As I said before, we also ask questions around what should be the measurement basis. So first of all, whether there is any need for financial measurement of around this type of intangibles, and what should be. So should it be fair value, cost, or value in use? So first of all, we found that according to especially the results that we got from the survey, the financial measurement was mainly indicated as a preferred option by preparers when it comes to human capital, corporate reputation and image, customer list, while for user, it was much more around information on brands, IP, and intangibles related risks and opportunities. But then we also found that there was a convergence between users and preparers on the use of cost when it comes to information on R&D, software and information system and training, fair value when it comes to information on brands and intellectual property and know-how, and value in use for information on human capital. Position of information, so where this type of information should be located. Also in this case, we found that there was a convergence of both preparers and users to provide this type of information in the supplementary notes to the financial statement, but also in other type of documents, such as the non-financial reporting statement according to the 2014 non-financial reporting directive. As I said before, that is also mainly because the new European CSRD, so the directive on corporate sustainability reporting, wasn't out there, but also in integrated report and management commentary. Integrated report that is also now part of actually the assets of the I4S Foundation, as is the case of the management commentary. And this is also quite consistent to the responses that we got when we asked which is the current framework and or standards for the measurement and disclosure of this type of information. So quite consistently with where this type of information should be located, we heard from preparers and users that for both of them, a useful document and framework is the integrated reporting framework, but also a possible revised version of IS 38. Let's see what the IASB is going to produce in that respect, and also the EU non-financial reporting directive. In terms of the form of disclosure, so understanding whether how this information should be provided, financial figures, narrative information, a combination, or only KPIs, we found that both, again, preparers and users were quite reaching a consensus regarding a combination of both narrative, information, KPIs, and financial figures. So not really a preferred option, but a combination of all of them. We also ask whether, in the view of preparers and users, the disclosure of this type of information was able to overcome a cost-benefit analysis. And in this respect, we found that users tend to be much more optimistic than preparers, maybe also because preparers have to provide the type of information. And especially on this particular topic, we found that there was a particular class age between 40 and 41 years old that appears to be more skeptical about the possibility of this type of information to overcome a cost-benefit analysis. We also asked whether there is the need for this type of information to be subject to auditing, some form of auditing. And again, it was deemed as necessary for 64% of the both the professional categories, but we have been hearing also through the focus groups that some sort of, it is quite felt and shared among both among users and preparers that there is a need of a proper auditing standard. Again, that was far before the issuance of ISA 5000. So let's see if, for example, that auditing standard is able to provide a useful tool in order to audit information on this type of intangibles. Also in this case, it was interesting to note that, again, for age classes in between 40-49 and 50-59, the most selected response has been not necessarily. So for the people who were a little bit more senior, it was kind of not necessary to submit this type of information to some sort of auditing. We also asked a final question, which was about whether there is an overlap between ESG and intangibles related information, something that we have been kind of hearing and also during the previous presentation on carbon credits, which is also going to be interesting in the view of the fact that now there is not only the IASB, but there is also the ISSB within the remit of the I4S Foundation. And so what we have been hearing is that nearly 40% of users tend to share the viewpoint that there is some sort of overlap between ESG and tangibles related information, and that overlap is more than 50%, while again, preparers tend to be a little bit less convinced. And it was, again, interesting to hear during the focus group that for some people, intangibles are to some extent also seen as a sort of precondition to a good performance on ESG. And this is a quote that we actually you can find in the paper, but we also got from the focus group. So for example, to the extent that you're able to innovate your procedures within the organization, that is also going to allow you to have a better performance when it comes to ESG and sustainability. A last important question that we asked is whether there is a need of standardization of intangibles related information, and also in this case with different type of percentages. But yeah, there was a quite of a consensus between users and preparers. Now I'm gonna leave it to Stefano to finish up.
Under the control of Anna. So what we can derive from all we've seen from this empirical investigation, clearly, there's a difference between professional occupation, statistically proved, between users and preparers. Both of them think that more information on intangibles is a good thing, however, with different percentages. And this is statistically, as I said, significant, this difference. Interestingly enough, other factors like age, gender, educational background are not being proven important for the preference for more information on intangibles. Only the age class have been statistically important for a couple of questions like cost-benefit assessment and the need for auditing. We've just seen that. So, but generally, the only thing that really holds is the difference is the professional occupation difference. Of course, preparers, and not surprisingly, appear to be more conservative than users, also because, as Laura said, probably they have to prepare the information. So, three possible consequences for standard setters. Clearly, there are diverging views and diverging information needs between CFOs and of course, users and investors. And maybe this might be an important element in reviewing, you know, IS38 and in other related projects. A second possible consequence is the size of companies. We didn't have too much time, but also the size of company matters. Of course, large companies, CFOs from large companies have a much more relaxed attitude, so to speak. And of course, CFOs from small companies are much more concerned. So maybe the mandatory disclosures for what are now unrealized intangibles maybe can be differentiated between large-sized companies and small and medium companies. And of course, also the location of information is important. As you know, now in Europe, all the sustainability information should be in one section of the management report by law. And so, of course, this also maybe provide an important indication also for the future development of this type of disclosure, not only in the financial statements, but also maybe in the management report. Limitations, there are a number of limitations. We're going to conclude. Of course, there are self-selection bias in the survey respondents. Of course, the people responded were interested, per se. So that is a self-selection bias. Some questions were complex. It was a very complex survey. 30 minutes was the time necessary, but you needed to be a very good guy, a good person to complete in 30 minutes. Some questions were, you know, had multiple choice, and some others do not have the same nature, which of course makes sometimes mixed the type of answers, and it's difficult maybe in some cases to get cross-cut responses. In some cases, we asked to express preferences, but we didn't ask to rank them, because it was already complex survey, and the risk is that the guys were not answering us, basically. So these are some limitations. Of course, the focus groups are similar limitation in a sense. The list of potential candidates was provided largely by EFRAG, which, of course, again, we thank. But, of course, the 16, 17 people of preparers and 17 of users were not representative by construction of the whole world of the preparers and users. Future research avenues, of course, there's a, you know, as I said, we just started a walk on the wild side, so it's plenty of things to do. One paper we're writing is about, we also have specific, we have information specific intangibles and the preferences. Here has been a sort of a more overview. And of course, we can also disaggregate this information we got from users and preparers to go more in depth. That's for sure. We can also disaggregate the groups, as I said. And of course, we would like also to be consistent and, you know, not us, but all the researchers operating in this area with the ISB project on intangibles and the work also of ISSB and EFRAG. incidentally, it's interesting to know that even GRI, they are interested in intangibles nowadays. So it seems to be the interesting convergence between all the various standard setters. Thank you very much for your attention.
All right, so first of all, thanks very much to the organizers for the invitation. I'm especially pleased to discuss this paper because it brings very good memories. And I don't know if Stefano remembers, but 13, 14 years ago, I was a PhD student, and I received a call to attend a conference in Ferrara to discuss a paper by Baruklev. And it's a paper about intangibles. And of course, being a PhD student, and of course, still now, I was terrified, right? And so what did I do? I went and checked and read all possible papers that I could get my hands on. And I came across this fantastic exchange of ideas between Baruch Lev and Doug Skinner that then ended up being published in Accounting and Business Research. And it was fantastic because you had the proposal of Baruch Lev, the counter-proposal of Doug Skinner, the rejoinder of Baruch Lev, and the rejoinder of the rejoinder. And so you can imagine myself trying to get wrap my head around how to come up with useful comments for the paper. So now, with a little bit more experience, I'm especially pleased to discuss this paper because it falls also into an area that is very dear to me, which is not only quantitative data, but also alternative ways through which one can present findings that are informative, in special ways to regulators. Now, to summarize the paper, basically what they do and the aim of the paper is to provide some insights on the perceptions and views of preparer and users on the usefulness of potential information that may be disclosed about intangibles that are unaccounted for. So intangibles that are unreported, undisclosed in traditional financial statement. How do they do that? Well, they design a web-based survey that they make available, and then they follow up with some focus groups for both preparers and users. Why they do so? Well, obviously, because they want to inform standard setting, and they want to directly contrast the views of preparers and users, and this is an innovation compared to previous research, because you have papers that focus on either preparers or users. And the other important thing is that this is a paper about perceptions. What do I mean by perceptions? So think about when we, let's say, market-based accounting research traditionally study measures that want to capture the usefulness of accounting numbers. We use outcomes, right? Whether there is a correlation with stock prices or stock returns. But here is a chance to actually ask directly users whether this information is useful or not. So basically, it's a step back. It's reducing, let's say, the chain and going at the source of the information. The key findings in a nutshell, basically the main finding is that the current state of reporting for intangible assets is not up to standards, so it's unsatisfactory. In terms of contrasting the views of users and preparers, users seem to be more prone to change, whereas preparers, as you would imagine, are a little bit more conservative because, of course, they have in mind the costs that are associated with the preparation of more informative and potentially longer financial statements. What do preparers and users agree on? Well, first of all, they agree that there is possibly not the one best way of depicting intangible information on in financial statements. And therefore, they call for a combination of key performance indicator, narrative disclosures, and financial numbers. But also, what they seem to agree on is that there is a need to audit this information, which seems to suggest that, of course, given their nature, this information needs to be tested for some degree of reliability. Now, currently, some comments on the theoretical development of the paper. Currently, there is no theoretical development of the paper because explicitly the authors aim to let the data speak. Now, I'm going to slightly push back on this because the paper aims to inform policymakers, right? And if the aim is to basically produce something which is potentially going to push for evidence-based policy making, there needs to be some sort of theory to inform what you are planning to do. And in fact, even though you say you let the data speak, you do formulate certain questions, and you formulate questions in the survey in a specific way. And so there must be a theory that has informed the way in which you organize your questions. And in fact, what I think you could do is to articulate a theory that focuses on the objective function that users and preparers are trying to maximize. So what is the utility that they derive from information on intangibles that are still not accounted for? What are the expected costs and benefits that intangible disclosures can generate? Think about the preparers, right? If I'm Pfizer and I'm the first out with a formula for a vaccine, I wouldn't want to disclose it right away in my financial statements because there might be proprietary costs and other pharmaceutical companies can reduce my monopolistic power. Then the nature of the users, right? We talk about users in general, but the information demands of debt holders are very different from the information demands of equity holders. If I'm an equity holders, of course, the more the merrier, but if I'm a debt holder and then I think, wait a second, and if you write up this intangible on the balance sheet and the firm is going to approach default, well, how good a collateral is that going to be? I mean, this is just something that could inform your thoughts around a theoretical framework. And then the objective of financial reporting. In the back of your mind, I know there is valuation, but accounting information we know is also used for contracting, what in Europe we call stewardship, right? So assessing managerial performance. And so how potential conflicts across these two sets of objectives ultimately could shape an equilibrium outcome in terms of information that we could report in financial statements. So my suggestion is be more upfront and straightforward on the theory. And to build on this theoretical framework, my suggestion is also to kind of construct the questions and to basically group the questions around the potential answers that standard setters would be very interested in knowing the answers. So, for example, what do we mean by intangibles? What are these intangibles that are still not accounted for? Is the overall definition of intangibles the same? So do preparers and users have the same intangible definitions in mind? And then have financial statements become less relevant, right? And if so, have they had as a consequence inefficient capital allocation in the economy? Comments on the research design, I think, because you are transitioning from a report prepared for standard setters to an academic paper, there are some details of the research design that are currently not discussed or not discussed enough. So, for example, regarding the initial sample, it's unclear how many subjects initially were targeted, right? So who was the recipient of this survey? What is the response rate, right? If we don't know what's the response rate of the survey, it's difficult to then make an assessment about how generalizable the findings are. And then 40% of respondents drop after the personal questions. Why is that the case? Were these questions too onerous? And then the focus groups, the sample size seems to be fairly small. So maybe you could discuss what they say, but when it comes to making inferences, you could be a little bit less bullish. And There are a couple of things about survey design. At some point you say in the paper, we use a between subject design. This is a terminology that usually is used in experiments or field experiments, also in economics, where basically there is a treatment effect that is administered to subjects, and then you contrast treatment effects across a treated and control group. Here you don't have such a research design. And in fact, there is something where you also mentioned that treatment is randomly assigned, but you don't actually have a treatment. So possibly this comes from the fact that you are revising the paper from a report into an academic paper. You currently have some univariate comparisons, but comparing means across different groups like this, given that they are different under many dimensions, might be not the best way. So consider running a multivariate test. You do have the data, and so you can do that. And I would say that for academic research to be policy relevant, we need to make sure to understand that descriptive research is useful, but it needs to be caveat in a certain way, right? Because of course you cannot identify cause and effect, and standard setters that probably may not be as research savvy as we are might take it out of context. Last thing, the UKEB, the United Kingdom Endorsement Board, is running a similar survey. You may want to take a look. They also want to understand the usefulness of intangible information. This survey is still ongoing, and there are representatives from UKEB around. So do talk to them. In conclusion, very much enjoyed reading the paper. I think it's very relevant and super timely. My suggestions concern the theoretical development and the way in which you organize and present the findings. And thank you very much, and I wish you the best of luck.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's my pleasure to provide some comments on this as the standard setter discussant. So great to follow Stefano and his very useful comments. And thank you to Stefano and Lara for all your work on this paper and to your co-authors as well. The version that I'm commenting on explicitly relates to a paper that was available to me two weeks or 10 days ago, and I know the authors are still working on things and updating things. So some of the comments I want to make, I think, have already been addressed, and you'll see that within the presentation materials that the authors have put up today. But nevertheless, I want to be able to speak about the tables that were presented. And so in some ways, I'm hoping my discussion is very complementary to Stefano, who's focused on the academic side. So thank you to the researchers for taking this on. I think it's well demonstrated to be a highly topical area. And as they pointed out in their presentation, it is interesting to try and bring together the views of the preparers and the users. And indeed, you've got a third column that's not really doesn't really feature in my version, but you have a third column for all these other people that participated. So I think you can do something with that in terms of your descriptive work. This range of views. The slide on the screen at the moment very much mirrors how Stefano and Lara introduced the paper and the sorts of things they were trying to cover. I think. There is a real call for us to understand the area before the IASB can scope the project. They need to know. So these types of papers where people dig in and try and gather information for us feed into that process. So thank you for that. So with my comments, and excuse all the type on the screen, but I didn't know how else to present this. My comments are going to be around each table that I got to see and how I responded to those. So in terms of table one, I had the same questions that Stefano had. Who are these respondents? Where are they coming from? What experience have they got? Now, I think you do have that information and you've started to release that now. But that's particularly important to me. So who are they? What is their professional experience? What industries are they coming from? Because what we've already heard about in our meeting is how important industry sector is in this area. And what's their IFRS experience? Looking at your stats that you gave me earlier, in that, firstly, you're very much drawing from Europe. No problem, but just make it clear who you're drawing, because it really affects how you interpret this, because we know that it matters where the people are coming from. So not a problem that you're heavily drawing from Europe, but you need to recognise that. Your sample size is such that you probably can't be dividing it up very much, but at least make it a buyer aware situation so the users of this information know where it's come, which is Stefano's point. I'd be interested to know about IFRS experience. Now, I realise you can't go back and ask questions again. I'm going to make some comments on your questions. The survey research, that's what it is. The questions as they are what they are. And your pool of people in your survey respondents and in your focus groups, you can't change that. So let's just work on explaining as much as you can about who they are and how you set it up and what you've done so that the user can interpret that. In terms of IFRS experience, the thing that jumped out for me when I saw that screen, and it will have jumped out for my fellow board members, is you'll prepare a group, more than 50% of them identify themselves as having unlisted companies. Now, there are also a lot of Europeans there, so that means they're not using IFRS. So in some countries they can be, but in other countries they aren't using. So it's very interesting, the IFRS, the IASB theme that comes through. So, you know, maybe there is scope for you to be looking and understanding the subgroups within your group, but I'm not pushing that point given relative small sample size. But they're the sort of things that I question when I start seeing what the composition of your sample is. So the more information that you can give is helpful. So in terms of the questions, if we look at the question that framed table one, I look at these questions and I think, well, what is this question really asking? So I think it'd be helpful, if you can, that you actually provide your questionnaire, and that may be in your paper or it may be on an online appendix, because I want to understand the question that you actually asked. Because in the version that I got, and albeit it was an earlier version, sometimes the headings and the text of the question didn't line up. And I don't know how much you're summarising your question. I don't know if that's exactly what you asked them. Are they the exact words you used? I don't know. I don't know if you gave your people more information so that they can understand what you're asking them. Because that, of course, is the thing about survey work. How was your question interpreted? You rightly say you're dealing with people's perceptions, and that's great. But we, you know, are these things defined in any way? And later on, when we get to the big table, we're talking about all the different intangible assets and all the different ways of measuring them. How much lead did you give them? Did you just put those words on the page and they had to interpret? Or did you say, oh, by fair value we mean this, and value in use we mean this? So just give us more information about what you did, albeit it might be in an appendix, because I know that you'll be under word constraint in your paper. And I did like the way you structured your paper with your tables and then with the comments that are relevant to that. I did like that structure. I just think the tables themselves, the analysis of the tables needs work, and I'm sure you're working on that. So for me, I looked at the question and I went, is this question broad or is it narrow? You know, are you asking about financial reporting, which someone might take in general, or are you asking about IAS 38 specifically? So where's the focus? And I know you can't ask them again, but if you've got more information about how things were interpreted, share that with us. So table two, There is a lot of agreement between the preparers and users about the important areas, and Stefano pointed us to that. So we're dealing with a huge topic area. We're dealing with diversity of views, but you've also found some common threads, and that's helpful. Table three, where you looked at the cost-benefit test, that's great. That's something that standard setters look at all the time. It's a really fundamental part of how we approach standard setting at ourselves, FASB, and national standard setters, thinking about cost-benefit test. It isn't a surprise that the preparers are more cautious. We've heard from preparers today. Their living, breathing, working world means one thing, and investors come with different needs. So we can expect that. Table four is the big one. Or it was in the previous version, with all the lists of types of intangibles undefined in what I saw, and then asking for people's views about things. So the sorts of questions that I thought as I read that, as I looked at it, I was looking at whether the reported statistics lined up with, for example, current practice. Is it reflecting what people are currently used to doing? So, for example, with training, their approach to training was expense, but their approach to human capital was a bit different. And I thought, well, what are they actually thinking about in terms of human capital? And this is very much what we don't know. One of your items is organizational capital. I have no idea what organisational capital is. Did they have an idea or not? So just bear that in mind. I looked at their preferences around whether they wanted to do a fair value measurement or whether they wanted to do a value in use measurement. And I assumed that it's about future cash flows, but of course with a fair value taking market participant inputs and the value in use taking entity-specific inputs. So, just even if you don't know how they saw it, just flesh out and explain for your readers that specifically if you're following accounting standards, they are defined terms, and some of these people will have accounting background, and they will be drawing on that knowledge that they have. Table five, that's my 1 minute. Perfect. It's my colleagues laughing. This is not a subject of humour, Bertrand. This is serious. This is intangibles. Table five, in the form of the information, I thought that reflected a lot about practice, which made me think, as you analyse, there's things that are already in place that people are already doing, and how much are we going to build on what is already there, and how innovative are we going to be? How much do standard setters need to step outside the box and think differently, at least in initial stages, to get new ideas and things? Location of information. There was a lot of support for this notes to the financial statements, which interested me. I think you need to tie that back to where they've also got a preference for disclosure, not recognition. Because when you say in the notes to the financial statements, what did that mean? Did that mean some sort of note disclosure which was then audited, but it's not recognition, what standard setters would call recognition of an amount? So you might want to relate those two. And I'm nearly finished, Anna. The table seven was very exciting for an IASB standard setter because there was a lot of reference to IFRS frameworks. Both the existing standard, the management commentary project, and also integrated reporting, which you've pointed out is also in the IFRS family now. Again, support for EU frameworks, but that will reflect the sample that you're drawing from. And all I want to say about the rest of that really is that there's evidence then coming through your work of the call where people want to have perhaps have commonality in frameworks, which really mirrors what was happening over in the formation of the IASB, and also something that we often talk about at the IASB, which is information in one place. So that's an idea that is possibly coming in through here. And I'll stop there. Thank you. And we're going to...